Good evening and welcome to Wednesday's Late Debate. Joining us to debate today's developments, we have Barry Ward, Fine Gael Senator and Shannon spokesperson on Justice, Eoin O'Riordan, Labour TD for Dublin Bay North and spokesperson on Education, Enterprise and Trade, Holly Cairns, Social Democrats TD for Cork South West and spokesperson on Agriculture, Patricia McBride, lawyer and political commentator, and Daniel McConnell, political editor with the Irish Examiner. Now, we want to hear from you, so do please get in touch. You can text us on 51551. You can email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate_RTE. So in 2 hours' time, the entire country will be on level 5 restrictions. Lockdown Mark 2 comes with substantial fines and threats of jail for breaching COVID restrictions. Although this evening we hear that former Rural Affairs Minister Michael Ring has said he will not vote in favour of fines for people in rural Ireland who breach the 5 kilometre travel restrictions. Eoin, I'm sure a lot of people will welcome these new penalties that will give the Gardaí some teeth if they are going to police the restrictions that we're facing into.
Well, I don't know about that. I know that we're all utterly depressed and flattened by what we have to do. I know everybody, no matter what their political colour or where they are in Irish society, is you know, feeling down about it, and are going to wake up tomorrow feeling down about it. But we have to power through these next 6 weeks and do the best. Now, the question we have to ask ourselves, trying to row in behind the national effort and trying not to score political points, but we do, as an opposition, have to look at legislation that's brought before us and ask, you know, pertinent questions about it. When you're trying to get people on board with a national effort, there are two messages that you can send out. One is the positive message as to why we're doing this, which is to help save lives, help suppress a very dangerous virus, help keep schools open so that in a number of weeks' time, or maybe a number of months' time, when we get a vaccine, that we can pull all this behind us. You can have that message of hope, or you can have the message of fines and punishment and, you know, Garda checkpoints, etc.
So, can you not have carrot and stick, though?
Well, my point is that there's a piece of legislation coming to us tomorrow, which is going to be rushed through the houses over the next couple of days, which is quite a significant piece of legislation. Now, I can understand where Michael Ring is coming from, because the big difference between 5 kilometres in Dublin Bay North and 5 kilometres in rural Mayo, within the 5 kilometres of where I live, there's pretty much everything that you would need. It's probably very different than West Cork or Mayo or Clare or parts of rural Ireland. Now, my point to government would be, rather than, you know, I suppose bringing in legislation which the Gardaí are not even calling for, and that's quite clear. Gardaí representatives are not calling for it, they're not asking for it, and they also feel as it's going to be unenforceable. To instead of that, to push the hopeful message as
we're
needed
these
things.
Just be clear on that, because I was listening to the GRA rep being interviewed this afternoon, and my sense of what he was saying was that it might be useful in some circumstances. You know, to give people teeth. In those circumstances we've all heard about of house parties and you know, being asked to intervene in these situations.
I know if you live in an area and you get the sense that somebody around the corner is having a house party and putting everybody at risk, that you do want to have some mechanism that the Gardaí can respond to that, right?
But is this not it, though?
The point is that, well, it's a very subtle balancing act, and I know governments have to make this balancing act, and I appreciate they're trying to do the right thing, all right? But it's all about messaging and about hope and getting people on board. There's a very small, at the moment, small movement against all of these measures. They don't need very much of an encouragement to grow and to be more vociferous and, in my mind, more dangerous.
And you're worried that this might feed into that?
Yeah, my worry is, and I appreciate the government are coming from the right place on this and trying to do the right thing. I'm not suggesting that they're not. But when you rush through legislation that isn't given the chance to have proper scrutiny, which it won't have over the next couple of days in Leinster House, when you're bringing in legislation which is going to have such, you know, stiff penalties on people, when it's going to have a disproportionate effect on people
people in rural Ireland versus people in urban Ireland, and you already have resistance from within a government party, then government have to think again as the messaging they're giving people, the hope they're giving people, okay, and are they bringing people with them?
Okay, but are you going to vote in favour of this legislation?
We're going to look at the legislation and do our best to amend it, to improve it.
But you're not talking about voting it down?
No, at this point, we reserve the right to vote whatever way we want. We will in terms of legislation we don't think is justifiable. But at the same time, we do, however, understand the need for restrictions, and we do understand the need for citizens to play their part.
Okay, Anne, I want to bring in Holly Cairns. Holly, where do the Social Democrats stand on this? Would you share some of those concerns that Aon outlined there?
I would share some of them. I think on lockdown powers, it's a very negative approach. It's an approach of punishment, not encouragement. And I think we forget that we actually managed to get to zero cases during lockdown one. And this was done through a huge public effort. The public will play their part, but the government needs to play its part too. And public confidence and solidarity require clear communications from government, clear evidence that issues in relation to tracing airports and the potential for an all-Ireland strategy are being delivered. And of course, tracing, which I'm sure we're going to come to later.
Oh, OK, all of those issues obviously are important, but in just specifically about this legislation, what is wrong with this legislation in your view, if you think there is something wrong with it?
Yeah, we'll be discussing it as a party tomorrow in terms of what we'll be voting on it. But like I said, I just think the approach from government needs to change. We don't need this negative approach that is one of punishment when we should be encouraging people to all do it together. Like I said, we did that before through a huge community and national effort.
Well, we're in a very different place now, Holly.
Well, we're still trying to beat the virus, and we know that that approach worked in terms of, like, I do think we forget it. We got to a point of zero cases after the first lockdown. And in terms of being 2 hours to lockdown, like you said, Katie, it's so hard for businesses and society in general. And I think we need to be really in this together again, because, you know, and things that would help that in terms of recovery of this lockdown too is businesses simply can't pay rent, rates, loan repayments and insurance while they're closed or immediately after they reopen. So if we want our economy to recover and we want people to actually be in this together, they need that reinsurance. And for people to go back to work, we need those businesses open for people to have jobs to go back to.
I just want to stick, if I can, with the legislation that will be voted on quite shortly by the Oireachtas. Barry, you could call it draconian. I mean,
I don't think you could for a moment. No? Actually, first of all, draconian is a word that's grossly overused.
Jail, yeah. for having some people around your house.
You see, you can put it that way, but like what Holly said there, I think is fundamentally misunderstands what's happening. The suggestion, for example, that the government is taking a negative approach is absolutely untrue. Not only is the government doing its level best to support people, and we all recognise it is incredibly difficult, particularly for businesses who are deemed non-essential, but what we're looking at is a situation, and neither Holly nor Aon appears to have suggested any alternative, where we're asking the guards to go out and enforce new rules without any tools to do so. Now, you're quite right, there are significant penalties in there. It's not draconian, by the way. It's in line, for example, with road traffic penalties. So it's not draconian. And I understand what you're saying. I'm not saying it's nothing at all.
But is it the same as road traffic? A fixed penalty fine for speeding.
They've modelled it very substantially.
But fixed penalty fine for speeding is €80, is it? The last I saw it. It's €1,000 for a first offence and a possibility of a jail term.
Well, hang on a second, Katie. What it is the maximum €1,000 for a first offence. That is the maximum jurisdiction of the court. And the reason I say it's not draconian, and coming back to the point that I really want to make is, and you remember during the last lockdown, Leo Varadkar talked about this a lot, about policing by consent, policing by agreement of the people. That's the first port of call. And many of the members of the government have said these are the last port of call. This is where people are willfully ignoring the problems that they're creating, putting their neighbours at risk, putting their friends at risk, and not listening to the guards. Then and only then are the guards invited to potentially use this as a stick, as you say, to put them back into line. But
guards not going to be authorised under this new legislation to stop somebody on the street who they have some reason to believe may be on their way to a house party.
Yeah, reasonably believed. That's right.
So that's different from what you've just described there, that only after the neighbours and after everything else.
Hang on a second now. There's a difference between what you've said there. Yes, they are entitled to stop somebody, absolutely, and to give them a notice, absolutely. But what I'm saying is that this is a last resort for somebody to be prosecuted under this Act. Every member of the government that I've heard speaking about this has said that. The guards themselves have said that. And that has been their practice up to now. So it is policing by consent. But what appears to be suggested is we shouldn't give them any powers. We shouldn't give them the right to enforce these rules to protect all of us from it. Now, I'm not saying this legislation is perfect. And I actually agree with what Aon said about rushing it through. I think that is a negative idea. And I'll be tabling amendments to this in the Senate tomorrow.
What amendments will you be tabling?
Well, I have an issue, for example, in Section 3, where they're putting out those fines. They set out fines for first offence, second offence and third and subsequent offences. And then there's a section which says that actually if the judge thinks it's a particularly bad case, he or she can actually ignore the fact that it's a first offence and give a higher penalty, which I think
is
a nonsense.
Which is the point I was...
No. Yeah. Well, it's not.
Well, if it's going into that it can be up to...
No, well, it can be. But what we're doing is we're giving judges discretion. Now, the problem is...
What amendment are you suggesting there?
What I'm suggesting, you should take out this paragraph that allows them to ignore the fact that it's a first offence. But the point that I'm making is that when you've maximum... They are sealing offences. They are very rarely... Sealing charges, sealing penalties. They're very rarely applied. What it gives the judges a range, and you would expect judges to exercise their discretion responsibly there, as they do in every criminal case in the country at the moment.
Patricia, can I bring you in?
Yeah.
As a lawyer looking at this legislation here, would you share any of the concerns that Aon and Holly raised?
Well, I do, because I think that our focus really needs to be on community solidarity, respect and support, and not on recrimination and punishment. We know that there's a rump of people who will flout the rules.
So what do we do with those then?
We do have to have the power to try and curtail that. I would disagree with Mary about removing the discretion for a first offence, because realistically what we're looking at, a judge has to have discretion if there are particularly aggravating circumstances around that. We can't predict what may or may not happen. But I think the biggest concern that I have in looking at this legislation is that it signals to me that the government strategy for dealing with COVID is going to be a series of lockdowns. It's going to be a series of restrictions. It's not looking at a bigger picture. This is a short-term fix, and it's not really addressing a longer-term strategy to where we get to the point where we're living with COVID as opposed to trying to deal with a series of lockdowns. That's the much more concerning picture, and really how we get to that point where we can, encourage community solidarity. It's about creating, the next level of public health messaging. Everybody knows wash your hands, wear a mask, stay 2 metres apart and restrict your contact with others. So how do we reinforce that that's something that we have to do in a longer term, and it's not just something that, you can do it until we go back to a level 3 and then you can kind of forget about it. That's where we're going wrong here, and I don't think that this legislation is going to fundamentally tackle those problems.
It expires in June, this legislation. There's a sunset clause in here that means it has to be renewed by the House of the Oireachtas on the 9th of June.
But there's
months away, Barry.
And the point being made, the clear messaging, Barry, is absolutely essential here. And you say you're doing your level best. Mm-hmm. And in fairness, there's been a constant complaint that there isn't clear messaging, and this is another example. Perhaps you need to do this in certain situations, but what we're talking about and what people are listening to on the radio is about punishment and fines, and the messaging needs to be more positive, less to do with punishment and more to do with encouragement, and like Patricia said, solidarity. The messaging is massively important in this situation. We're going into another lockdown in winter months and people are hearing this.
But can I put to you, Holly, though, the point that Barry raised there earlier, that the Gardaí are powerless in the current situation. And we all know, we've all come across cases where people were completely openly flouting these regulations and recommendations and putting public health at risk. And do we not need to give the Gardaí some powers
to curtail this.
To curtail that kind of activity.
Yes, and the point that I'm making is that the messaging around this needs to be more positive. Like I said, for listeners now, it feels like we're going into another lockdown and the focus is on how can we punish people who are not following the rules. And I'm just saying that it's also really important that we send out a message of, we're in this together, we need to do this for public health. And, you know, Barry saying we're doing your level best, there's so much more the government could do because people are playing their part. And like I said,
perhaps
we saw that in the last lockdown in terms of quashing the cases. But they need to work with opposition. They need to, the World Health Organization have insisted on this over and over again. Tracing and testing
and that is
so important.
And that has been
invested
in.
And do more than say it's an impossible task to take an all-island approach.
Okay,
so ambitious.
We're very much in favour of it.
Okay, we will move on to that in a moment. I want to bring Daniel in. Daniel, you are our resident spokesman on parliamentary party meetings. I understand that Michael Ring, the Ringer, had plenty to say about these fines at the Fine Gael parliamentary party meeting this evening.
He certainly did. And, you know, it's not that long ago that Michael Ring himself was sitting at the cabinet table and drawing up these sort of fines, etc., like that. But I mean, he's made it very clear that he sees this as an unfair stick, particularly for those living and operating within rural West Mayo. And ultimately, I suppose, as Aon made the point earlier on, like that, you know, operating within a 5 kilometre radius in Dublin, you know, pretty much everything is on your doorstep. It's not the case in Mayo. And, you know, he sounded more like a Healy Ray than he did than a government TD earlier on, given the utterance that he made. But, you know, there is some sympathy for him within his own party. I mean, texting an awful lot of his colleagues, you know, they would share their concerns. You know, they kind of know as a government, public appetite and public, I suppose, fatigue is certainly kicking in relation to the pandemic, and they have to walk that line in order to keep that public that public support and buy-in, because ultimately, you know, you can make all the rules that you want, but if the government or if the public are fatigued and are kind of eschewing and kind of turning away from sticking with the rules as they have done rather brilliantly so far, then I think the whole thing is in real difficulty. But I mean, he certainly said that you know, level 3 should have been in enforced much better than it was, and I think there's a legitimate point in that. And we're reporting in the morning, we're doing a big special 2-pager on the sort of the internet of what happened to the announcement of level 5, and it's clear there was an acceptance at the highest levels of government over the weekend that, you know, the softly approach taken under level 3 simply didn't work.
Danny, have you tracked down where that story developed? Because there seemed to be a massive change of heart over the space of a couple of days from what was being reported from government sources on the Friday, Saturday, into what actually emerged out the other end.
Yeah, so what's very clear is on Saturday that there was a meeting of the three leaders before they took a briefing from NEFID, and that the three leaders realised, because obviously they would have had Tony Holohan's letter from last Thursday, which recommended going to level 5 for 6 weeks in their possession. And I think there was a realisation that, you know, unlike 2 weeks previous, they were in a position to actually deal with this and consider the matter over the weekend. They got the briefings from NEFID. There was a lot of pushback politically from the likes of Michael McGrath, Pascal Donoghue and others who said, you know, we need to stick with level 3 or worse, go to level 4. But the medics were very clear that nothing short of level 5 would have worked. And
Where was Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin then at that point when there was pushback from the two men in finance?
My understanding as at that stage, Leo Varadkar was committed to the idea of going to level 5, but for a shorter period. So the idea of going to level 5 for 3 or 4 weeks with a review after 2 weeks.
So ultimately, was it the Taoiseach who pushed for the full?
Yes,
whack,
is my understanding. It was the Taoiseach's ultimate who kind of was more, he was less concerned about the levels, but was more concerned about, you know, the science. And I think the big debate that went on within government was, what is the difference between level 4 and level 5? And I think the ultimate conclusion was that in terms of limiting business movements, etc. like that, moving to level 4 was the key one. That's the one, as they say, broke the back of businesses. Like, you know, that was the one that really limited.
Yeah, once you had gone to 4, it's sort of almost like you might as well go to 5.
Exactly. Well, that ultimately was the conclusion that they made. And what they also did was, my understanding is at that meeting on Saturday, NEFID had only modelled for level 5. They had not modelled as to what the impact of staying at level 3 or level 4 would have been. But they were told to go back and do that. And what ultimately what showed was that going to level 4, you would have had a lower, the rate of dropping the R rate, which is the key metric now,
would have happened
much slower. Yeah. So NEFID were pushing for a much harder much more restrictive lockdown than ultimately the government went for. They wanted to get the rate down to 0.5 rather than just 1. So, I mean, there was a real ding-dong behind the scenes over those few days as to the approach taken. But, you know, the line given to me by several sources who were involved with the process said, you know, ministers were trying their best at all stages to try and give businesses as much of a chance as possible. But, you know, ultimately they decided to go that level 5 for 6 weeks.
Well, ultimately we are where we are now. I just want to give you a sense of what our texters, our listeners are telling us. Prison for people having people in their home isn't draconian, says Ed. Gardaí don't want these disgusting powers, all to distract from government tracing failings. But I have to say a lot of our other listeners are of the other mindset. Wake up, Holly. Every parish in the country has at least one shebeen going. Next day, the patrons are shopping in our shops, attending local functions, out and about spreading the virus. Gardaí need powers to help us now. The naysayers to this need to get a grip. We have Katie. I'm sick and tired of being punished for the ones who don't care about anyone other than themselves. So find them, lock them up and throw away the key, says Eileen McCann in Dublin 16. Another texter says, spoke to some 18 to 25 year olds this evening. They told me they organised parties no problem because they knew the Gardaí were powerless. So all this bleeding heart sympathy, though well intended, is misguided. And one final one there, Aon and Holly are recklessly encouraging people to disobey during a global crisis. They are wrong. The new laws are not strong enough. Aon.
Look, what we are trying to achieve here is a common goal across politics. We're doing our best, and we are entitled to view government action or inaction in that way. And we are supportive of many government measures. We supported the move to level 5. We are not playing politics with pub closures or whatever as others have done.
I'm trying to nail down where you are on this.
Look, I am somebody who is, you know, a citizen as much as anybody else. And I have experience in other fields as well, as apart from politics. And I do know you can't police yourself out of every social ill or social difficulty. That is my experience in life. That's my experience throughout my career. And if people feel that the way to get through any social difficulty or any national need is to put the boot in, well, then it doesn't always work. And sometimes it builds up resentment and sometimes it's counterproductive. So what you have to do is have a balanced approach. So what we're going to have over the next couple of days...
Are you saying that this isn't a balanced approach?
No, I am saying that because, a lot of the messaging from government over the last period of time has been really regrettable. I think the actions of the Taoiseach have been really regrettable. I think his discussion on the Claire Byrne live show on the Monday evening, where he totally undermined the chief medical officer, was really regrettable. I think we have social media platforms from Fine Gael with backbench TDs criticising government policy, which is really regrettable. We have the Taoiseach who's obsessed with Sinn Féin and that sort of over and back between himself and Sinn Féin, rather than dealing with the national issue. So what we're saying in the Labour Party is quite clear, is that we are a party that will always stand by the national effort. But when we see people going the wrong way or making the wrong emphasis or doing the wrong thing or rushing through legislation, as Barry has already agreed that this is being rushed through, we are entitled to make points as to the direction and how agree, we can bring people yeah, with you.
Would you not
and,
agree, therefore, okay, that the Taoiseach is also allowed to question when he disagrees with the CMO that it is right and proper that as the representative of the people that he says, I don't agree with that because I don't think it's not through because there are other consequences that haven't been factored in.
I think what he did was deeply regrettable. I think what he did was deeply... I think it took the wind that a lot of people who witnessed it at the time, indeed people in the very studio with him, were quite taken aback by his performance. And now we're at a position where, when we have gone to level 5, the very first question that was asked was of the Taoiseach as to his performance 2 weeks previously. So what I'm trying to say is this, if we get behind the national effort, we can achieve something. But if people just think that the only solution to this is to police our way out
of it...
Barry, I'm responding to the text messages that are coming into Katie there. If people think as a society you can police
your way out of every social difficulty.
But that's a misrepresentation of the text messages.
There has to be a balanced approach. Is what is my point?
Can I just respond to the text messages as well?
Yes, Holly, they were referring to yourself as well.
Yeah, we all support public health measures and accept that some restrictions on our rights are necessary in order to protect health and save lives. But these must be fully discussed and critiqued to ensure transparency and clear communication with the public. People are cautious about possible new powers, and indeed the Gardaí themselves are, because it hasn't gone through proper pre-legislative scrutiny. The main focus should be on informing and empowering people to make the right decisions, not punitive measures. I think we need solidarity and clear message
that.
And hope from the government.
There's a real danger here of suggesting, Aon has said this is imbalanced. He hasn't told us what he thinks would be balanced. Perhaps balance is no powers for the guards whatsoever. These are not draconian powers.
Let's be clear then.
The Gardaí do have discretion. The Gardaí always have discretion. That is a fundamental part of policing in Ireland.
You're advocating an amendment that removes judicial discretion in high day.
See, Patricia, I'm not sure if you've read the legislation because I don't think you understood what I said. In Section 3, paragraph B, there are three different penalties set out according to whether it's first, second, third or subsequent offence. There is then a paragraph that says that it essentially doesn't matter. The judge is not limited if he or she feels it's a particularly aggravated offence. What I'm saying is that the judges should be restricted to minimising the penalties. I'm not advocating for greater penalties, quite the opposite. But I'm really concerned, Katie, that the suggestion that this is what the government is all about. Hang on, Patricia, please let me finish the point. You're advocating for removing judicial discretion to impose a higher penalty. Yeah. Yes, I am. That's right. Because I think that what's the point of putting in a register of penalties for first, second, third offences and then saying actually it doesn't matter? That makes no sense to me.
Because the law has to be able to take aggravating factors into consideration.
Of course it does. And that is exactly what a sentence hearing is for. And every judge considers mitigating and aggravating factors when any sentence is being handed down, and they're not restricted.
Okay, just very quickly, because I really need to move on.
This is not what it's all about. This is a small part of the reaction. If you look at every minister, they've been talking about social solidarity. They've been talking about helping people to the greatest extent possible. That's how we'll solve
it. Okay, and they've been talking about contact tracing, because we've all been talking about contact tracing. I want to go back to that story that broke in the Irish Times last night, and we were able to bring it to you live last night. And this is that the contact tracing system became so overwhelmed that thousands, 2,500 people who tested positive for COVID were asked to do their own contact tracing, effectively. And it emerged that Health Minister Stephen Donnelly only became aware about this last night, while today the Taoiseach said that he only found out about it when he was texted a link to that Irish Times article. GPs were asked to deal with the backlog of close contacts of COVID-19 cases. Have a listen to two GPs now. This is Dr. Matthew O'Toole and Dr. Ilona Duffy describing their workload.
We're completely overwhelmed. In our practice here, we're trying to run a flu clinic today. We're trying to see all the non-COVID patients. And as I'm talking to you, my screen here is lighting up with people who are requesting COVID-19 tests because they're close contacts. So it is overwhelming.
Ilona, is it the same for you there today?
I'm looking at the screen as well. It's completely full. I actually have another role that I do today, but I've come into the surgery and I'm sitting here trying to help field some of the calls.
Yeah, so that's just a sense of how overwhelmed not just the contact tracing system, but the whole primary care system and GPs have been in relation to this. And I know we've been talking to public health doctors over the last couple of weeks, and they are absolutely, at the end of their tether with the workload that has emerged. Danny, there was a huge furore about this in the Dáil this afternoon.
There certainly was, and it dominated leaders' questions. This afternoon, the Taoiseach was asked by Mary Lou MacDonald, Alan Kelly, Catherine Murphy, Cathal Berry, etc. like that. And, you know, he made the stark admission that he only found out about this by way of a text message, I think, which included the Irish Times article. So that meant he would have only gotten that message very late last night. And the subsequent admission that Stephen Donnelly only found out in around the same time raised all sorts of questions as to why was this not flagged, with all the sort of interactions that were going on between government and NPHET and the HSE throughout the weekend in terms of the Level 5 decision. Where was this issue, or why was this issue not flagged up? It raised issues like within government there were questions from ministers as to Stephen Donnelly's lack of awareness in relation to this, and that issue was raised by pretty much every opposition spokesperson in the Dáil today. And in fairness, those questions are legitimate because it's such a crucial factor in the state's response to COVID-19. And any sort of undermining of that process of contact tracing really cuts to the core of, you know, Holly was talking about earlier on about the social solidarity aspect. If you're going to, on one hand, be introducing fines, you have to at least, and shutting businesses down all over the country, you have to be able to have confidence in the state system that testing is sufficient, tracing is sufficient. But we're 8 months into this pandemic now, and I would have a real concern that what were they doing during the summer when the numbers were low?
Let me just put that to Barry, because that is a question I think a lot of people can legitimately ask now.
But they were increasing it.
No, they were not in June and July.
Barry, seriously.
In June and July, because I'm aware of people in this who were in the system. They were sitting around twiddling their thumbs, and then one by one, they were all being sent back to where they had been temporarily pulled from. And they were not. The talking to the public health specialists and others in this area, they're saying yes, now we are beefing it up. Mm-hmm. But we weren't doing this back in June.
In June and July, first of all, we were still in restricted. There were still restrictions in place, and the numbers were going down all the time at that stage. But after that, it is absolutely the case that they were being ramped up. It takes time, obviously, to recruit people to do this, and I know that there were 1,100 people
involved.
Wasn't this why we should have been doing it in June? Well, I don't know if it was possible to do it in June, and I don't know if it was necessarily because we were still in restricted circumstances there. But what I'm saying is that I know that over 1,100 applications have been processed for people to work in this area. I understand that 72 people started a week ago, 65 people started the week before that. There new people into that process. Listening to opposition spokesperson the Dáil today, you would think nothing had been done at all.
No, but Barry,
doctors have been saying for months that they are understaffed and under-resourced.
Yeah, absolutely. But
Catherine Murphy's been warning this for weeks, and now 2,000 people have to basically do a DIY on testing.
Yeah, but where are all these public health doctors that you're saying we should be employing? Where are they? We can't magic them out of thin air. Well, we're talking, there's two separate strands we're talking about here. The first is public health doctors. And I've been on the show with you the last time, Katie,
talking about contact tracing. It's true, that's the second strand. Donal didn't know. It's an incredible breakdown of communications between the HSE and the minister, as well, which is worth noting.
The figures
this
that
is
I
the price of failure to fund public health for a long time.
Holly, that is a different issue to what we were discussing. When I was talking about figures, I was talking about contact tracing. They were the figures I was referring to. And I thought that's what we were talking about. There are two strands. But those numbers have been ramped up, and there have been recruitment processes involved in that, and it's coming to fruition now, as I said, in the last couple of weeks, for example.
You referred to the fact that the last time you were in the studio, we had a very compelling interview with a public health specialist out in the field, and they told us that yes, now it's happening, but it wasn't happening when they were calling for it. They were telling me we are going to be in big trouble here if we don't do this.
Where is it that those doctors could have come from?
Well, where are they coming from now?
Because why weren't people returning home? There are public health doctors who were living and working abroad who are returning home. They wouldn't have come home in June if we had organised recruitment in June. They weren't in a position to.
Are you telling me you're familiar with this recruitment process?
No, because I'm not saying, because they would have been welcomed, Katie. There's no doubt about it.
We weren't recruiting public health specialists in June.
In June, the numbers were going down all the time, and there were still restrictions.
And that was the time, surely.
It was utterly predictable when the schools came back that there was going to be an increase in cases. It was just utterly predictable.
The concerning thing here is that all of the evidence, all of the public health specialists, NPHET, everyone has been saying, prepare yourselves for a possible second wave in the winter time, in autumn and winter. Why was the surge capacity not built into the system in March, April, May, when we knew what it would be like to deal with large numbers of people who were getting positive tests and were trying to introduce a contact tracing system at that time? The surge capacity should have been built in so that all of the people who were deployed into contact tracing at the start could have been pulled back into it at short notice in September when the numbers started to rise again. And I think that's the fundamental flaw in the system.
But they have been moving forward, Patricia.
And that's why the numbers I've just mentioned, some of the numbers from the last two weeks, last week and 65 the week before, you're talking about new recruits.
And that's in addition to people who've been pulled from other sectors.
The HSE need to be able to pick up the phone and get 100 people on the phone. Sorry to break it to you,
but that's what COVID is about. Every week we get new information. Hold on, a pandemic is about realizing. Can I just say one thing before you come back in? No country has succeeded in COVID. There are just varying degrees of firefighting.
Hang on a second. I have a clip that I want to play you of.
This has echoes of the economic crash when we were told about every other country having a difficulty as well. This is really worrying, the narrative. And just to say, just for the record,
because it's been confirmed to me here by my producer that the HSC advertising campaign, recruitment campaign, was launched in August.
I'm not saying that it wasn't, Katie. I didn't say anything other than that.
You appear to be suggesting that we were crying out for these doctors in June.
What I'm saying was they would have been welcomed. Anybody who wanted to come home, there were. Do you not remember Simon Harris launched the campaign talking about people coming back into the health service?
And I also remember huge numbers of stories of people who came back in those circumstances and were left stranded and never got any proper contacts.
73,000 applied, 200 people were taken in.
Exactly. Okay, you're saying this is firefighting all over the world and nobody has got on top of this and this is just the way we have to deal with the pandemic. I just want to play this clip of Paula Hancock. She's with CNN in South Korea and she's describing here how they are doing tracking and tracing over there because they have been very successful in South Korea in keeping their cases very low.
As soon as you have tested positive, within 10 to 20 minutes, and they have your phone number, they put it into a system. They know exactly where you've been for the past 48 hours. They take your credit card number and they can tell that really backs it up exactly where you have been. They use CCTV, they use GPS, they use everything at their disposal to find out exactly where you've been. And then what they do, if you've been to a very busy area, they'll put out an emergency alert on the mobile phone to people who have been in that area as well. Mm-hmm. So you know instantly if you're starting to feel like you have symptoms, you know you need to go and get yourself tested.
Now, that's a track and trace system that is very good.
It's a track and trace system that infringes on people's personal liberties.
Now, that's my question that I'm going to put to Aon. To what degree do you think people are willing to trade their personal liberties and their privacy to get to a situation that they have been able to get to in South Korea, which is one that the whole world envies.
I appreciate that question and as that goes up the previous question and that you asked in terms of, you know, the balance between encouragement and policing. But I would say this, look, this is about the balance between firefighting and getting ahead of a problem. Now, it was utterly predictable that when the schools came back that there's going to be issues. All right. Now, about managing those issues was going to be difficult. It is utterly predictable, by the way, that the winter is coming. It is utterly predictable that the weather is going to get colder and that people are going to be, you know, getting sniffles, etc. This is all utterly predictable. It is utterly predictable that you're going to need this level of contact tracing in the field ready to go. It is also predictable that we're going to be dealing with this probably for another year. I think that is pretty predictable. We can't predict when the vaccine is going to be. So it is utterly irresponsible of government not to be ahead of this. I'm dealing with education, right? We are now dealing with a system that is, I want to be very careful with my language here, but there's teachers who are doing incredibly difficult work and the system is now under an extreme amount of strain because the support mechanisms from the HSE and public health teams are insufficient.
Okay, I want to move on and do education as a separate issue in a moment, but just get back to the interesting and we will get back to that point.
It's all interconnected into how government are dealing with this pandemic in terms of planning, resourcing or firefighting. And if you're firefighting, you can't get the public on board because it feels like you're not competent. How could you have a situation where the teacher stands up in the door and says, I only learnt about this situation yesterday when somebody sent me the green screen grab of the Irish Times journalist's report on it. It appears that the Irish Times journalist know more than the Taoiseach of the country, and he admitted that on the floor of Leinster House.
I think, Barry, a lot of people will be concerned if the idea that our approach to this has to be firefighting.
No, okay, let me just be absolutely clear. Every country in the world, including South Korea, is firefighting COVID. You're firefighting until you have put out the fire. The fire is still burning.
So but that's you what plan. I, hang on a second. You plan, plan and you plan.
Yes,
plan.
And that is
and
exactly.
And you plan for what's predictable, which is winter.
And that is exactly what the government has
and
been
schools
done. It is not the case.
But is that not exactly the point that has been raised? That
the country,
in June, when the numbers were down, that was the time. To build up the capacity. But we did not see that happening.
There is not a problem with contact tracing because we recruited in August instead of June. That's not what the problem is. And the suggestion from Aon,
certainly the public health specialists say that is the problem
Different issues in terms of the recruitment health doctors.
They are related issues,
they aren't,
I think you'll
because
agree.
The people doing those two jobs are different people and they're different jobs. But Aon is suggesting now that the government somehow hasn't planned or hasn't put contingencies in place. And it's kind of irresponsible to say that, Aon, because you know
really?
It's not true.
Yes.
Really? No, but the fact of the matter, Barry, is that doctors are telling you.
It's doctors saying
saying that they had to
for suggesting that the government are being haven't planned when it's patently clear to the to the entire country they haven't planned. The Taoiseach is the one who stood on the floor of the Dáil and said, "I only learned about this from an Irish Times journalist." And the Minister for Health is the same. And you're saying to me it's irresponsible.
You don't need to shout.
I mean, this is unbelievable what you're saying.
It is the third or fourth time you've said that. It's an isolated incident.
An isolated incident.
Aeon, come on.
Okay, let Barry.
You have gone through a diatribe, which is primarily an attack against Fine Gael, by the way, rather than the government. But whatever about that, you've primarily told
both
us the government.
Both those politicians who are mentioned
there. Primarily told us the government.
But that's irrelevant. Go on.
You've primarily told us that the government has done nothing. Has done
no. I haven't said that.
That is primarily what you've been saying.
Failure to plan.
Sorry, every country in the world has failed to deal with this issue. There is not a failure to plan in this country. I've given you figures, for example.
Do you think South Korea failed to plan in putting that contact tracing system in place?
Not in the
context.
No.
The reason they did that was because they had a very difficult situation with MERS 5 years ago.
From the get-go, Katie, they've been the gold standard in contact tracing. There's no doubt about that.
And did we not all look at them and say,
what are they doing and why aren't we doing that? We also know that we cannot do what they do in South Korea because we have personal liberties in this country that are stronger than they are in South Korea. That is the reality of the situation. Our response along the same lines was the COVID tracking app. And even that got a lot of criticism from certain people, but it worked very well. That's just one measure. There is a list of things that the government has put in place. I gave you figures, for example, of an ongoing recruitment process in respect of contact tracing that is going on all the time. Aeon will still sit there no matter what and interrupt me and tell me that the government hasn't planned when it has. Has it done enough? No, it hasn't, because no government in the world has done enough, because we will not have done enough until either this virus leaves the country or we have a vaccine to deal with.
Okay,
let's
move on.
So let's be a little bit more responsible about the language that we use.
Okay, well, let's move on to education, as we touched on it there. And you just in passing in things said there that, you know, we knew that issues would arise when the children went back to school. We knew that would happen. But we're being told repeatedly by the NPHET and the modellers there that there hasn't been an increase in cases among that cohort, that age group that are school going, since the schools went back. And I know we've seen the numbers of outbreaks have gone from 12 to 24, 25, and then up to 46 in the space of 3 weeks. But we're still being told that. Do you accept that?
Yeah, look, I accept that schools must stay open, can stay open. I accept that. I also, though, know from listening to principals and principals who are in contact with me and teachers who are in contact with me on a very regular basis, that they are crawling towards the midterm break because they are exhausted and fatigued, because the nature of teaching has changed. All of those elements of the school day that used to be there to find a balance within the day between academic and social outlet have been diminished. So it's a very difficult atmosphere for them. However, I'm also aware of the fact that they're getting contrary HSE advice or public health advice in different schools. I know that what's happening within individual staff rooms is concerning, because there's a suggestion that the principal or the board of management have information around a particular pupil or a particular teacher that they can't share. And I also know that the department have been, I think, negligent in not holding the hands of every teacher union, every education partner, every patron body across the system every single day when a briefing is needed, in order to ensure that they are on top of the various different issues that are arising all the time. I think it was a mistake for the Minister for Education not to have been involved at the talks over the weekend. I certainly think she should have been an awful lot more visible when it comes to the situation that people are worried in every school building around the country about these situations getting worse.
We're hearing that the department are on top of this, that over the midterm break, that the teams that are dealing with schools will...
But there's contradictory advice coming to individual schools who are told if you've only been in contact with that individual for the last 24 hours, well then that's all you have to worry about. That's what individual schools have been told, which actually contradicts the HSE advice.
Can I bring Holly in on this as well? Holly, this is something a lot of us are hearing. I mean, most of us know teachers have some teachers in our kind of wider circle, and there is a lot of concern about. Are they being treated different to every other citizen in the state when it comes to contact tracing and the issues around that?
Yeah, the school situation, I think, is evolving rapidly, with some evidence of cases rising and a kind of a rumour mill in full flow as well. There needs to be, like you said, rapid test and tracing in schools, and there needs to be a far greater level of consultation with teachers and school representatives and NPHET. Because in general, everyone is keen to keep schools open, but schools need resources and we can't separate them from other issues in terms of things like testing and tracing. So we need to use the time that we have in this lockdown to get tracing right, and that should start in schools. And we need a far greater level of consultation with teachers, because understandably they're, you know, at risk when they're going into schools and they don't feel like testing and tracing is happening correctly. I heard of one school whereby there was a case and the HSE were doing tests, and they were, you know, instructed that they were just going to do a test on that so-called bubble in the school, and the teacher insisted on the entire classroom being tested. And the result of that was that there was an additional 7 cases, which wouldn't have been identified if they just tested within the so-called bubble. So understandably, teachers are concerned, you know, like they're the frontline workers. And, you know, there's not enough resources being put into keeping them safe and their families. These teachers go home in the evening and perhaps live with people with underlying health conditions.
Yeah,
we have to listen to their concerns.
Yeah. Barry, I'll let you back in now, because that is a huge issue. We have teachers who have families to go home to, and that they may be people they're very worried about in those homes.
I mean, of course they're concerned. And I say this as the son of a teacher, the brother of a teacher, the nephew of teachers. So I do understand that, and I admire the fact that teachers put themselves out there. Holly has said they need more resources. My understanding is that all of the resources in terms of PPE and equipment in schools to carry to put in place whatever measures can be have been provided.
And testing and tracing for that.
Can I just ask you on that front, because we had Breed Smith in here last night. We had Ruth Coppinger in last week, and they both said they knew of cases where teachers were asked to pay for their own masks, to buy their own PPE. Yeah.
Well, I don't think that's defensible if it's the case, and I don't know about individual cases. My understanding is where schools have asked for equipment, they have gotten it. But what's much more important, there was a suggestion earlier that it was predictable that numbers would go up when kids went back to school. Kids going back to school, we know, have not in any substantial way contributed to the increase in numbers. The transmission of the disease amongst children is totally different. The symptoms amongst children is totally different. Of course, in terms of contact and tracing, that's important, but that is not part of the problem. Teachers are not, as I understand it, more at risk, for example, than frontline workers in other areas in the medical field, in the in the retail field, bus drivers, people involved in public transport.
Probably more at risk than you are, Barry, to be fair.
I'm not saying that. I'm not a frontline worker, although I am in court. And I do meet people in court as well. But people who are dealing with members of the public are at risk.
Perhaps for the lower age
group. Classrooms aren't big enough to socially distance to, you know, like...
Well, actually, Holly, I don't think that's correct, because every school has been given protocols to put in place to protect teachers and students. Now, I'm not talking about it. I don't know every classroom in the country.
Well, exactly. In some classrooms in the country, you have 4 classes in one room.
But the point I'm making is, the schools have been given the equipment to ensure that there is the greatest possible level of protection. But, I mean, you could make the same argument about small shops, supermarkets, hospitals, courtrooms,
small
whatever
shops
it might
be. Restrict the number of people go into
them, can,
6 at a time.
And by the same token, there's facilities available to separate children, and we've talked about the
but you're not appreciate that when a school is getting
contributed... You need a building to facilitate that for many schools. It's not the same.
Yeah, but I think when the school gets contrary advice, then what is the public health advice? When siblings are getting contrary advice in 2 different schools, when you have a situation where, the system as it operates is that if a GP is aware of a student or a teacher who has a positive test, they go to the public health team. The public health team then advise the school as to what to do. The autonomy of the school or the individual principal to make their own decision in that regard is really limited. And so the dynamics that the principal will be aware of, or board of management may be aware of, are put to one side or have been asked to put to one side. Now, I think the department needs to work with schools an awful lot better. And in this really unique situation of a pandemic that we're all trying to work our way through. Now, I made the point, or the point was made, that I know you're trying to...
Yeah.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, I need to move on. I could stay on this for another hour, but just one quick thing that I noticed in one of the press releases, the suggestion that we need an urgent review of the wearing of masks at primary school level. That's
Well, look, I'm quite sure these things can be discussed. I would be really reluctant to have a situation where primary school children are wearing masks. I think that takes away from everything that the primary school is about. But look, I think we have to constantly challenge ourselves all the time as to reasons why we do things, and if that needs to be, you know.
But I think the figures suggest into, that it's not necessary.
Yeah,
that's
my okay. They can look at it, but I'm quite sure they come up with the same as the current situation.
We're so up against the clock, and I want to touch on that direct provision report today, because that's obviously a major development after many years of talking around this. This is, of course, the advisory group chaired by Dr. Catherine Day. She's made a number of sweeping recommendations on direct provision. These include 6-month statutory time frame for processing claims, once-off grants to people who have lived in the current system for more than 2 years, and increasing access to the labour market and to own-door accommodation for asylum seekers. Now, of course, this comes 5 years after the McMahon report, which again had, you know, recommended loads of sweeping changes and was warmly embraced at the time, but very little happened. Here's the author of that report, former High Court Judge Brian McMahon, on the News at One today.
Although it was embraced and received enthusiastically, it was not implemented, and there was no plan set up to implement it, and there were delays. And as a result of that, I think that the direct provision system was fatally wounded, so that by early June this year, the government has committed to abolishing the direct provision model and replacing it.
So, as I say, there's lots of targets in this report, Barry, and it would massive changes if they were to be introduced. But of course, we could paper this place 100 times over with the pages of expert group reports that never, saw the light of day.
I think the recommendations are important, though. Some of us have been saying for a long time that we need to deal with this issue. We were dealing today with mother and babies home legislation. I think that this is the mother and baby homes of our time. We need to deal with it. I welcome changes that were made, for example, to allow people in direct provision to work. It was a really important step forward, but we're still a long way from resolving this problem, and we need to take concrete steps to do it.
Yeah, Aon, really quickly, because I want to just get one touch on that mother
and
baby
home.
Well,
I remember commissioning the McMahon report, and I remember the draft programme for government of the last government had a line in it saying that they were going to implement it, and then with the actual programme for government came out, that line was actually deleted about implementing the McMahon report. But two good things in terms of own door accommodation is crucial.
They'll be one of the most difficult, and also
with the local authorities being involved in overseeing the system would be key as well. The labour market, look, there's a Supreme Court case on that. That's the reason why that was happened. And six month time frame was in the previous report. We did manage to get the long stay residents and direct provision down from 2,600 in 2015 to 1,200 in 2017. So there have been successes over the last number of years, but as Judge McMahon said, I'll be impressed when this is implemented, because the last one was.
I think the difficulty, just very quickly, the difficulty. There's a broad agreement across and political consensus and community consensus that the for-profit model of direct provision needs to end. But the difficulty I see is shifting that responsibility to local authority housing and having them shoulder the burden of that. There needs to be a much better programme in place where, because there's a lack of local authority housing as it is. We can't make that problem bigger. So we need to put a support structure around ending direct provision and providing people with their own homes.
I just see a text straight in off the mark there, Katie. Are we for real? Own door accommodation? We can't house thousands of our own citizens. That's Michael in Clare. I'm sure that is a debate that will roll, but I just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to just touch on another really important issue. We've touched on it in this programme many times. This is those documents from the Commission on Mother and Baby Homes. The Minister for Children today, Roderick O'Gorman, he has committed now to having a re-examination of the government's plans to manage the records of mother and baby homes. He was speaking in the Dáil. He urged TDs to pass legislation which he said would preserve records on the homes before the Commission of Investigation was dissolved at the end of October. This is such a confusing issue, I think, for people to get their head around. I mean, Holly, do you think the Minister blinked here in terms of this debate and where it's gotten to?
Yes, and I think that he's realising that. I think, you know, it's not that confusing an issue, because one of the really important things to do during a debate like this is to remember the gravity of it. We're talking about the worst human rights violations imaginable: missing children, enforced disappearance, illegal adoptions, incarceration, and so much more horrific, systematic institutional abuse. We have to remember that this commission was brought about when there was 800 dead babies and small children found in a misused septic tank in Tuam. You know, it's difficult to imagine any other scenario whereby crucial information about crimes of this magnitude, when no one has been held to account, would be sealed away for 30 years.
Holly, that's going to happen already. That was put in place by the 2004 Act. And I have been stunned because I watched your speech in the Dáil this evening and that of many opposition politicians who have said that this is about sealing documents for 30 years. It is not. And if you like, Holly, please point me to the section of the bill that says that. This bill is all about safeguarding an incredibly important database that was created by the Murphy Commission, which is a map to all of the documents involved here. It's not about the documents. It's about saving that database, which will expire at the end of this month.
OK, so what is he really examining then? What is he committed to re-examining?
The time period, the 30-year rule applies from the time that the evidence was given. So the commission was set up in 2015. After that, interviews, evidence was gathered. Each time the person who gave evidence was given a commitment that that evidence would not be opened up for 30 years. As I understand it from what I saw from Minister O'Gorman today, he said he was thinking about bringing that back to 20 years. But we have to remember that people gave evidence on the express understanding that it would be locked away for 30 years. And we have to break that promise.
So why not just anonymise the records?
Anonymise it. Yeah, we know the sealing away of archives by previous governments, gagging orders, the hostile treatment of survivors
but
by state
stars in the recognise
is compounded
that is not
trauma
in this
for
bill.
So many people.
And
it's
you made a speech
again
in the Dáil today saying that that's what it's about. It's not what it's about. All this bill does is safeguards the database that will help exactly the people you're talking about
at the
find
very
the
least,
information
Barry,
they need.
People deserve respect and to ignore
and they,
survivors'
absolutely,
pleas to
and
change
this bill
this
does not disrespect them. This is the problem,
that
there is a misinformation campaign underway.
Look, at
here.
The end of the day, there's one point here that I think is so important. At the very least, we could do this with proper pre-legislative scrutiny. This can be put off. We don't need to do this week.
It's not in
and
this bill.
And it disrespects
it's not
the reality. Survivors.
Holly, tell me where in the bill this deals with sealing the records.
Well, the sealing
tell
of the
section.
Archives to be presented to the Minister for 30 years isn't permissible under EU law. And even where national legislation
but
allows
this
for restrictions...
show me where
Even
it says
where
that.
National legislation allows okay. for restrictions on data subjects' rights, those restrictions must be tightly limited and necessary for overriding purposes of national importance.
Okay, you
How
know...
How is that important?
We have a history of staying silent and silencing people on these issues.
Okay,
and when
okay.
we do that, we hurt
Holly,
the thousands of people who have suffered.
Where the bill
and at this
seals
point, Barry,
okay.
if the legislation is pushed through in its current
we
form,
are, I'm so sorry, Holly.
To save the database by the end of the month.
We will return to this. We will return to this, I promise, but we have to go now. I'm way over. I have to take my last break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And we are right out of time. I just want to thank my panel and all of you for listening and all of you for sending in all those texts. We didn't get to as many of them as I would have liked. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and Jamie Doyle was on sound. And now, with apologies for our lateness, it's over to Colin Murray on Late Date.